Hello and welcome to the latest Brewing podcast. No surprises, this is our post-election carve up, what it means for investments and also some political insights that we think are pretty unique. But before we get to that content, please keep listening because we have some very important disclaimers for you.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello and welcome to this latest Brewin podcast on this historic day where the Tory party have, as you all know, delivered a stonking majority. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Research Director here at Brewin Dolphin, and I'm joined by two extremely tired-looking colleagues, our Head of Research, Guy Foster, and Paul Dennis, our Head of Investment Strategy, clearly both up all night assessing those election results. Our agenda for this podcast, it may not be so linear, but is to cover how investment markets have reacted to the extent we think that is fair, and our expectations for the future, but also try and tie in a few more political comments in relation to what we think the Conservative Party agenda is under Boris, what the future is for the union, I mean, thinking about the performance of the SNP in that regard, and what next for the Labour Party, of course. So let's begin with our area of expertise and markets, and we have seen UK domestic stocks perform extremely well. We've seen sterling rally. Why has this happened, Paul? And perhaps I'll interject at some stage with asking you whether it's fair or not.
Yeah, the fact that the Conservatives won a solid majority, so we'd previously kind of established that, you know, that threshold at 340 seats. They've won well above this. So I think the fact that they've won a solid majority, one implication of this is that it marginalizes that Eurosceptic ERG wing of the Conservative Party and makes leaving the transition period following Brexit, which will begin presumably on February 1st next year and ends at the end of next year, it makes leaving that transition period without a free trade agreement and reverting to WTO terms less likely. I think it's more likely now that if the UK and the EU haven't agreed on a free trade agreement that there will be an extension. Or there is, it actually raises the likelihood that there is going to be ultimately an agreement on this, on a free trade agreement, potentially even before this transition period ends. So I think, you know, that's one point to make.
Well, I guess let me interrupt, Paul, because I like my own voice. If we go back, I mean, I guess there are some, we could contest that a little bit. We don't know exactly, or we don't quite know enough about the new entrance to the Conservative MP additions in the House. They could slot straight into ERG slots, you know, so perhaps they are, may still yet prove to be a sticking point for Boris's agenda. But he has laid out these self-imposed deadline that 2020 is going to be, end of 2020, no deal, we'll walk away. Yeah. Sorry, if we haven't got an arrangement, we'll just walk away without a deal.
Yeah.
We've seen a speech from Boris this morning talking about One Nation conservatism. Guy, our head of research, would you have a comment to make on whether you think Boris will be beholden to that deadline, or do you see perhaps his liberal values will mean that he'll rather an extension in that instance?
I would expect him to extend the negotiation period, just because everyone's understanding really is that the ability to negotiate a free trade agreement in that time is just too difficult. And I mean, I would agree with the comments already made. Essentially, you're right. The new intake of Conservative MPs particularly have all been much more aligned on the issue of Brexit. But just like the number of zealots, the number of people who have a such an extreme perspective on this, and are and for whom Brexit is the one and defining issue within the parliamentary Conservative Party. I think it's just it's not going to be a huge number. It's not going to be big enough to overturn the majority that Boris has got to play with. So, you know, we work on assumptions because he's a prime minister who, to put it charitably, you know, his view has not always been 100% consistent throughout his career on issues such as Brexit, for example. But we take at face value the fact that he seems to be a more moderate than the hardline wing of the Conservative Party. And he has such a strong majority, he should be able to push that more moderate stance through.
Okay. So, Paul, I interrupted you. So the next phase of the sort of questioning would be the extent we think UK assets are potentially overreacted in the sort of shorter, medium term, or whether there is a sort of a good sort of fundamental sort of story here.
No, I wouldn't want to underplay the good news here because, I mean, you know, it goes without saying that the fact that, you know, Boris Johnson is going to remain PM, I mean, that eliminates any chance of the hard left policies of Jeremy Corbyn or John McDonnell obviously getting implemented, which is a big fear of the market. It also lets businesses benefit from the country moving past the first stage of Brexit and the visibility that all that entails. It's certainly the rally that we've seen in the pound on the back of these developments have been justified. The one, I guess, question that we have now is that, you know, the next step is negotiating the future trade relationship, and there's lots of uncertainty around that.
Well, I want to get to that. I know we're not sort of hedge funds here, but we're thinking about in the relatively short term. What lessons can we draw from the past in terms of market reaction? Guy, I don't really think about sort of the referendum result or Trump's victory.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you have something in the calendar like this, an event everybody knows is going to happen, there's naturally a lot more money ready to be deployed when that result is known. And so we see this all the time, particularly with things like monetary policy meetings, or very often the ECB meetings in particular, when you're waiting to find out what size of stimulus or something like that. But the same with the 2015 election, same with the 2017 election, same with the Brexit referendum and with the Trump election. What happens is you get a very instinctive reaction from traders to the result that's come in, and that's not really focused on valuation, it's focused on sentiment. And then over the next day to two market days of action, there's a bit of a sort of price discovery exercise where actually investors like ourselves would look at the different prices suddenly on offer and say, well, actually, you know, there's an opportunity to take a bit of profit on that thing that's absolutely flown, or maybe there's an opportunity to buy that thing that's done poorly. So looking at the referendum, for example, you know, there was a great opportunity to buy house builders, real estate, retail assets, you know, things which for which the environment was genuinely worse after the referendum. But in the immediate aftermath of the result, the prices on offer were sufficient to compensate you for that.
So on that basis, I think the implicit message is in the short term, there could be some reversal of these outsized gains. But, you know, it's hard to get too cute about it. We wouldn't be surprised by that sort of
action. Yeah, I mean, like, you never use that as your sole sort of perspective, but it would be consistent with everything that's gone before, that actually the market overreacts, particularly when it's a surprise. And so you're more likely than not that you're going to get a good opportunity by fading that reaction rather than by chasing it.
Okay, right, let's go back to the sort of medium-term outlook then for the pound. I may sort of draw you back in, Guy, in a moment on this sort of the S&P performance, but let's think about the free trade agreement. And I know, Paul, you often look at market positioning on the pound as well, but I don't know where... please take over.
So that's the main issue, I think. Looking ahead, is the UK now is going to negotiate its future trading relationship with the EU. And so it's going to, I mean, we know that Boris Johnson wants to ditch you know, the current kind of seamless trading relationship that exists, and go for something less integrated. So, you know, the kind of question that everyone's trying to answer is, this will come with economic costs. How much benefit can be gained from striking free trade agreements with other countries around the world that will make up for some of the downside from...
Well, we've already had the congratulatory message from the US president, haven't we? And
yeah.
Promising much on trade.
Yeah.
So that... One, as some quarters may see that as being very good news for the UK economy.
Yeah, so, you know, let's see how that happens. But, I mean, one thing I'd flag is that this is the first time a country is ever leaving the EU. So the EU doesn't want to set a precedent that encourages other countries, particularly the weaker areas of the periphery. Italy is a big standout, to encourage those countries to go down the same path. So because of this, you think it's right that the EU is going to be a pretty tough negotiator when it negotiates its future trading relationship with the UK. It does want to have a strong trading relationship with the UK, obviously. I mean, there's, you know, Germany's sending in a lot of cars to the UK, France is sending in a lot of champagne and wine, so it does want to have a strong trading relationship. But what's more important to the EU is the, the cohesion of the European Union itself. So because of that, I think it will be a tough negotiator. So there's no guarantee that we're going to see this amazing trade deal that kind of gives
immediately anyway
everything. Yeah, everything he wants. I think negotiations will be quite tough. It's going to be, you know, a degree of uncertainty.
And what we're seeing on positioning, on the
so
pound.
On positioning, yeah. I mean, you know, heading into that meeting. Between Boris Johnson and Irish PM Varadkar back in early October, we saw, you know, heavy net short positioning in the pound. And, you know, the implication there is that when you get, you know, very net short positioning or very net long positioning, whenever it's extended one side or the other, when you get, you know, when you get news that moves in a direction opposite to how traders are positioned, you can tend to get quite big moves in whatever it is you're looking for, whether it's an equity market or currency. So now, I mean, we've got you know, the shorts, the traders have kind of closed their short positions, which makes sort of, which gives the pound less upside to good news compared to where we were previously back in early October when there was this good news around the EU and the UK agreeing on a Brexit deal, and you had that big rally. So now, I mean, with traders kind of net neutral in terms of positioning, it's not like there's not that same amount of, I guess, of responsiveness to future good news.
Yeah, so we like if the market is very long the pound, it's sort of a contrarian indicator that the next move would be to sell it.
Yeah.
If the market's sort of very short the pound, there's less sellers out there, so more likely to react to better news. But from this stage, at this point in time, there isn't a strong signal then coming from positioning at that basis.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, the other thing that's happening in currency markets today is the dollar's a bit weaker, and there is some pretty big news driving that. Do you want to share more with our listeners on that?
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been an official announcement yet, but it looks like you know, sources are saying that China and the U.S. have reached kind of the first stage one of a trade deal. So to the extent that this represents, you know, de-escalation in trade tensions between the U.S. and China, that's very good news for the markets. And, you know, generally you would see the more cyclical currencies and equity markets rally on the back of news like this. So that would include the commodity currencies, EM currencies, particularly Asian currencies, and the euro as well, which is traded as a more pro-cyclical currency since the global financial crisis. So, yeah, that's a
pretty
positive
big news.
Development for risk assets, yeah.
Okay, so we're staying on the pound, and the other big news in amongst... Well, the big news is the strength of the Tory party, the performance of the Tory party, the weakness of the Labour Party. We'll come to that shortly, Guy, but also the resounding performance of the SNP, and obviously we saw Sturgeon's reaction to the victory over Jo Swinson's seat. Meant a lot to her, clearly. What do we think this means for the union, I guess, and the potential for in Scottish independence, and how that may sort of weigh on pound strength or not.
It's more symbolic than practical, I guess, is probably the way you would put it. It emboldens the SNP to believe that they have a mandate to pursue independence, but the overall result gives the Prime Minister and the government a tremendous resilience against the need to offer any kind of referendum. I mean, there has been discussion in the past, or there was a hint that Nicola Sturgeon made that that they might try and test the UK's ability to deny another referendum in the courts. So I guess that is a potential avenue, but it sort of sounds like that would be quite a long-winded process. And I think had there been a different election result, then there might have been pressure to try and get an independence referendum before Brexit was resolved one way or the other, because then that would enable Scotland to potentially be an EU member even as it's granted independence. But that seems like that would be impossible now. So the most likely course of events by some distance is that the UK will leave the EU fairly shortly, and that Scotland won't be granted an independence referendum for quite some time.
Okay, well, that was a very neat summary. Before we tack back to a final comment on investments, as I mentioned, the Labour Party had a very tough evening. Lots of explanations put forward. It's focusing, of course, on their straddling sort of Brexit policy, but others sort of pointing to their more sort of more radical, more extreme left orientation. Do we expect the Labour Party to now sort of tack back to the centre?
I think, you know, when we did a podcast of this at the beginning of the campaign, I would say, like, the main point to be made was that Brexit really kind of loaded the dice in this election against the Labour Party. So I think you have to recognise that anybody leading that party would have had an incredibly difficult time, given the majority of their voters were pro-Remain, but the majority of their constituencies were pro-Brexit, and just because of the way that the vote was fractured. But the factors that have really, really hurt them definitively as well is like the poor scoring of their leader. So that's clearly a big factor. How you ever determine which one of those factors was the most important, well, I guess, you know, it will only ever be speculation. And then also, I think, there seems to have been a sense of probably less important that lots of the manifesto was just not really realistic at all. And at a time when voters don't really trust politicians to deliver, to come out with such an unrealistic manifesto probably just adds to that. In terms of what happens from here, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's has obviously said he's going to step down. But the structure of the party, the way the party's organisation works, means that it seems very likely that someone of his ilk will end up being a replacement. And now we've seen that times before in the Conservative Party, that you have a leader who seems to come from from the Labour Party. You have a leader who seems to come from one faction, and actually they end up transitioning it a bit. So like Neil Kinnock ended up being a bit more centrist than had been anticipated. So, you know, you wait and see, but I don't think it suddenly means that this becomes a sort of centrist party all over again.
Okay, well, thanks, Guy. And then we'll sort of round out then with some comments from Paul, really thinking about UK equities from here. Of course, may want to explain why, but that will have it will be dependent to some degree on the performance of the pound. But do we think UK equities look appealing at this stage and in the context of this sort of election outcome.
Yeah, so we're optimistic on global equities because, you know, we see scope for global economic momentum to pick up. Monetary policy around the world is very accommodative and is likely to remain that way for the next couple quarters. So, you know, on the back of that, we'd expect to see UK equities rally over the next couple quarters. It's just relative to the global equity aggregate, we wouldn't expect to see UK equity market outperformance for really two. I mean, there's really two big drivers of regional equity relative performance. Number one would be the currency. So we're interested in common currency returns, given that we're not hedging the currency exposure. So for us, when the pound goes up, that's good news for the prospects of UK equity relative performance. And, you know, given the headwinds I mentioned earlier around the uncertainty of the future trading relationship, and that's going to weigh on the market pricing and eventually getting Bank of England rate hikes because of that uncertainty and the weak business spending that should occur as a result of that, you know, we wouldn't see the pound moving up significantly, slacking a catalyst from where we are right now. So that's one consideration. The other consideration with regards, again, to UK equity relative performance prospects is the sector composition of the UK index versus the global aggregate. So the UK market is heavily weighted in the commodity exposed sectors, oil and the miners. It's heavily weighted in financials. It also has the consumer staple products companies like the Bats and British American Tobacco, Diageo, Unilever, Reckitt, for example. It's also heavily underweight tech, which has been a strong performing sector over the last decade. So in order to kind of get bullish on UK equity relative performance prospects, you have to think that these sectors it's heavily weighted in are going to start to pick up relative to tech, and it's not clear that we're at that stage yet. So I mean, UK equities are clearly cheap. And as I mentioned, we think, you know, globally we'll get economic growth momentum picking up. We've got this extra visibility in the UK. Monetary policy is going to remain accommodative. So in absolute terms, expect them to rise. It's just not clear that UK equities are an attractive place to park your cash and expect them to outperform the global equity benchmark.
Okay, well, that's a very neat summary, Paul. Thank you very much for that and for Guy for your contributions. But of course, thank you to our listeners for taking the time to hear our thoughts today. We would appreciate any feedback you have on the Brewin Podcast. Let us know on Twitter referencing hashtag Brewin Podcast or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, whatever medium you listen to us through. But until next time, many thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.